approves or moves to approve the February 19th, 2020 amendments. Any discussion on those minutes? Not amendments, minutes. Hearing none, I will call for the vote on the February 19th, 2020 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The minutes are approved. So, members, you know, one of the kind of the major goals that we've talked about in this committee is to how to make the tax system and just kind of government overall more transparent, more accountable, maybe even more results driven. And because we spend about $48.5 billion every 2 years that goes out and from taxpayer dollars that go out for services to Minnesotans. And I think it's important that we know what type of results we're getting for those dollars. And we do actually have some efforts here in the state that actually keeps track of some of that data. And so we're going to hear from the Minnesota Management Budget on a results first program that deals with state government. And then we're going to hear from the state auditor that actually looks at a program that deals with measurements and results in cities and counties. So that's kind of the theme of today. So Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to hear this testimony today, but I'd also like to remind folks that you talked about the $48.5 billion from the general fund, but we also have another $30 or $40 billion of other taxpayer dollars that comes to Minnesota from other places, you know, either from the federal government or from licenses and fees and all that sort of stuff too. And we need to keep that in the conversation.
Representative Fabian, point well taken. And yes, that 48.5 is the general fund only. Exactly. So we have Patrick Carter here from MMB. So thank you. If you'd introduce yourself, and we're interested to hear the testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Patrick Carter from Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the invitation to present today on Results First. Our goal is to inform decision-making processes with data, research, and evidence. Our team, the Results Management team.
Mr. Carter, could you maybe pull that a little closer? These mics just have not been very loud. I don't know if there's a setting or something, but kind of in all the committees I've been in this room. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, is that better?
Yeah, I think just a little bit. But yeah, yeah, might have to lean in, even try the other one. They just...
Speak from the diaphragm. Isn't there a knob?
I don't think there's a knob there. But is there a knob there that could...
Yeah, and that
works better. All the way up for whatever reason.
Okay, so... Very good. So just speak as loud into it and as loud as you can. Thank you, Mr. Carter.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the results management team at Minnesota Management and Budget, we are nonpartisan staff and we value objectivity and transparency in our work of infusing evidence in policymaking decisions. It's our understanding that policymakers and administrators want to operate and fund programs that produce desired outcomes. However, there's lots of anecdotes and assumptions about what works. We hear the term evidence-based, what works, commonly, but in our office, we set a pretty high standard for what we mean by evidence-based so that we can come to executive branch leaders with that information to inform their decision-making. Increasingly, there is scientific information and approaches that we can use to get at causality, where we can cite robust research from studies within Minnesota, across the country, to get at what works using high-quality evidence. So for my presentation today, I'll provide a brief overview of our Results First initiative. We'll talk about that definition of evidence, that high bar that we set for ourselves when talking about evidence. We'll talk a little bit more about the Results First project and then provide some tools for finding evidence-based information. The Results First project started in 2015 when the legislature directed MMB to adopt the Pew and MacArthur Foundation results first approach. We began looking at human services and criminal justice programs soon after, and since have expanded to other areas as well that we'll talk about this morning. Since 2015, Minnesota has been recognized for the use of evidence in its policymaking process. Last year in 2019, Results for America recognized Minnesota's work as leading examples for both evaluation policies as well as identifying evidence and inventorying programs. But with those accolades, we believe that there's still a long way to go to begin incorporating evidence into policymaking decisions. So what is Results First? We frame our work around these four questions. What services are offered in a programmatic area? Is there evidence of effectiveness for those services being offered? What outcomes can we expect if those services are delivered effectively and with fidelity to what the research says? And finally, how can we use this information to inform decision making, whether it's at the legislature determining budgets, at an agency determining who an RFP awardee is, or just how to generally operate a program. Our goal is to produce evidence-based information that is understood, trusted, and used by policymakers to produce better results for Minnesota. So far, we've completed 8 Results First projects, primarily in the criminal justice, human services, and education areas. You can see those 8 reports shown on your screen or on your pages right there, ranging from adult mental health, child welfare, to public health. There are 2 projects underway currently. The first is E12 education, and the second is an evaluation of human services grants for evidence of effectiveness. Our stakeholders include an advisory committee with representatives from all 3 branches of government. Representative O'Neill has served on our advisory committee. We also have representatives from tribal governments as well as county governments. We interface not only with state agencies, but also with county partners, nonprofit providers of programs, as well as other community organizations as we do our work. So I mentioned at the beginning that we have a pretty high bar for defining evidence, and we feel like it's important to have that definition as we do our work so that we can robustly say something is proven effective or promising when we come to you or executive branch leadership. Our goal is, by setting this high bar, we're able to tell whether an intervention caused a change in outcomes. The emphasis there being caused. There's a lot of research out there that reports statistics or summary level information, but it doesn't get at causality, and that's what we're driving at in our work. So in order to demonstrate this, I have a couple of examples. So in this one, there's an increasing number of negative incidents, whatever that negative incident might be, and a program's implemented in a couple months after we see those increasing number of negative incidents. After the program has been operational for a couple months, we see those negative incidents go down. Most people would see this chart and think that program worked. It was implemented and the number of negative incidents went down. And that's true. If it were not for that program, the number of incidents would have continued to increase. We can say that program worked. However, it's possible that the number of incidents would have gone down on its own if not for the intervention. And in this case, the intervention actually harmed or slowed down the effectiveness of the program. So this is a little theoretical. Let's kind of look maybe a little more practical with another example. The chart that you have here is shows how we typically hear about a program's effectiveness. That there were 80 people served, that's a common metric that you probably hear from agencies or from constituents, that just the number of people served, it's an easy number to get. And then there was intervention, and then we found out how many people, in this case, got a job. So 80 people were served in a program, and after the intervention, 40 people got a job. Again, those are kind of common numbers that you hear from state agencies or nonprofits when talking about their work. However, this doesn't get at causality. That's not enough information for us to know, did that intervention lead to those individuals getting a job? Instead, this is on slide 9. This is the framework that the scientific approach for understanding causality. In an ideal world, we would take 160 people, randomly assign them to an intervention group and a control group, and look at what's the outcome, compare the outcomes of those two groups. In the example that we have on the page right here, some people in the control group may have ended up finding a job that we didn't know about if we just looked at what was happening to that intervention group. And so the intervention still might have been successful, but we don't know that unless we're comparing it to what happened in that control group. In many cases, it's not possible to conduct randomized controlled trials with government programs, or it's not ethical to do so. But there are advanced statistical methods to approximate this experimental design that we're talking about here. So this is the sort of the core of the standard of evidence that we're looking at in the work that we do. And even better is if we can take multiple studies that use this scientific approach and combine them together into one result. So as you can see on the slide 10 right here, we're looking at four robust studies, four studies that meet that high quasi-experimental design standard, and we're looking at an overall finding from those studies. We refer to this as a meta-analysis. It's a pretty high bar to have four robust studies and taking the result from those four robust studies. So kind of taking a step back from these examples, we've relied on the expertise of several research scientists who understand intimately how experimental design works, and we've incorporated that into our standards of evidence that we use when we're rating programs. And so I'll walk through those ratings, and then we'll talk about how it's been applied in programs in Minnesota. So the first rating that we give to programs is proven effective. As I mentioned earlier, this is a pretty high bar. There must be multiple high-quality, rigorous studies for a program to be classified as proven effective. If there is one robust scientific study, we will classify that intervention as promising. And then we have a neutral rating that we call theory-based. So this means that there either hasn't been enough evidence or there's no evidence for us to make a determination of how a program is operating. This is not a bad thing for something to be considered theory-based. All promising and proven effective programs were theory-based at some point. It's just that we don't have evidence to make a determination of whether or not that program works or not at this time. So our next two levels of evidence, mixed effects. So this means that there's evidence, robust evidence, indicating kind of a bifurcated approach, that there's some positive benefits of that program and some negative benefits of that program. No effect means that there's research indicating that that program does not have an effect on the outcomes that we're looking at. So to distinguish that from the theory-based rating that was on the previous slide, 11, that's where there was no research to indicate that met our level of standard of evidence, whereas no effect, there is evidence, and it indicates that there is no effect for that program. And finally, proven harmful. This means that there's that high level of evidence indicating that the program has negative outcomes for individuals. Just one example of something that's proven harmful, because that's something that we get questions about, is the Scared Straight program. We didn't really operate a Scared Straight program in Minnesota, but it was popular nationally. There was a television show of the same name. And after robust experimental design research, it was found that the Scared Straight program actually had negative impacts. The whole premise was that individuals who were maybe going down, they had several encounters with the criminal justice program as youth, that you would meet with current offenders or ex-offenders, and that would kind of scare them straight. And it was found that individuals who participated in that program were actually worse off. They were more likely to continue in the criminal justice system than those who did not participate in the program. And again, there's high-quality, robust experimental design research that gives us that information that says Scared Straight was a proven harmful program. So we've kind of talked theoretically so far, and now let's take a look at how this structure has played out for Minnesota programs. So through those eight areas that I mentioned earlier, we have cataloged about 550 services or programs occurring in those areas. Across and looked at 20 different outcomes across those eight service areas, and the categorical ratings of those 550 programs are shown on slide 14. So about half of the programs that we've looked at are theory-based. Again, that means that there hasn't been evidence or enough evidence for us to make a determination of whether or not something works. About 25% have been proven effective, meaning they meet that highest bar, that highest standard of evidence that I was talking about before. There's about 20% that are promising, meaning there's some robust experimental design research indicating that those programs achieve one of those 20 outcomes. And finally, there's about 5% that have no effect, mixed effects, or some other outcome.
Mr. Carter, you don't do this with legislators, do you, and put them in these categories? So.
Mr. Chair, we do not.
No, thank you.
So you may be wondering, of those 550 programs, which programs fall into each of these categories? We have a publicly available tool that you, the public, state agency staff, nonprofits, citizens can look at. Those 550 programs and what their rating is. We call this the Minnesota Inventory. The website's shown on slide 16. And we find there's two general ways that individuals can use this tool. The first is by identifying a desired outcome. So if you're looking to develop a policy that will reduce adolescent alcohol consumption, that's one of the outcome categories identified in the Minnesota Inventory. You can select that, and you can see all of the programs that exist that are currently operating in Minnesota and what the rating, their evidence of effectiveness is right now. The other approach is maybe a constituent comes to you with an idea, or you're a county who hears about this program happening in a neighboring county. And you want to consider expanding the program, or you're the county and you want to maybe adopt the program that's happening with your neighbor. You can go on here and search by the name of the program or kind of the content of what's happening in the program and find out the evidence of effectiveness. You'll see one of those six ratings for that program that's happening in Minnesota, citing evidence that already exists. We also frequently point people to the Pew Results First Clearinghouse database. So this is a national database. There's over 3,000 programs that are listed in the database, and they cite eight other databases. So it's sort of a meta database of high quality, robust evidence and from across the country, across the world. And again, this is a great place to start. If someone comes to you with an idea, you can kind of use their search fields here to see what evidence exists for this program or similar programs. Again, you can search by outcome if you're looking to maybe move the needle on adolescent alcohol consumption. Again, as an example, you can pull up this webpage and search for what programs exist and what evidence exists for those programs. I will note that we pinged a few of our colleagues at national organizations that do work like this, and we weren't able to come up with a clearinghouse that focused exclusively on tax interventions. There's lots of topics covered, and there's a few tax components to the Pew Results First clearinghouse, but we are not aware of a similar database dedicated exclusively to tax proposals. But if you know of one, we're interested in taking a look at that. So just to kind of rehash some of the resources that we've talked about, our website provides the definitions of evidence that I talked through at a high level earlier, additional resources for finding high quality evidence, trainings. All of our policies are posted on our website as well. We feel like it's really important to be transparent in how we're making these decisions when we're applying a categorical rating to a program. We want everyone to know how we arrived at that decision. So that information is publicly available, and we appreciate comments and feedback from you, the public, on how we're making those decisions. And finally, there's just another reference to that inventory. We've seen it be used across state agencies. We've seen legislators use it. Nonprofits, community organizations use that as a tool for starting a conversation about how do we incorporate evidence into our policy-making decisions. So with that, I'm glad to answer any questions. I know I went through a lot of content really quickly, and so I'm glad to go back and do a deeper dive on any subject.
Thank you very much. Members, are there questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I'm concerned that you didn't provide us with an example, an actual example. I'm looking on the website under higher ed, and I see a lot of theory-based ratings, and theory-based it's so elusive. So I'm wondering, we have all these programs in higher ed that are theory-based. How do you draw a conclusion that it's effective when it's theory-based? Because there's really nothing indicated here. And without seeing an example of the comparison between proven effective, promising, theory-based, mixed effects, no effect, proven harmful, I'm kind of left in the dark as to how really effective this program is. So would you comment on that?
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I have a couple examples that I pulled from our website on adolescent alcohol use, and so that's not directly to your question, but maybe can just provide some examples, and then can also answer more directly related to education. So in the inventory, this is just three programs that we pulled. The first is called Know the Dangers. It's a public awareness campaign about synthetic drugs that is determined to be theory-based. So again, we took that program, we talked to the agencies involved with that program to understand what its components were, and then we went out to these clearinghouses, to other similar organizations that compile evidence-based information, and we weren't able to find any robust information about that program. Research might exist, but it didn't meet our threshold for being high-quality evidence for that program. Another program, however, was called Life Skills Training, and again, we took a similar approach to this project and found evidence in a nationally recognized federal database that met our criteria for high quality evidence. So we were able to say that project was proven effective. So the difference between those two, they may both work, they may both not work, but based on the information that we found and the high quality evidence that exists for both of them, one of them we weren't able to say anything about it, so we said it's theory based. It's a neutral rating, whereas for the other one we were able to say it's proven effective because this high quality research exists. A similar structure would be taking place with the programs that you mentioned, Representative Erickson, where in lots of instances we aren't able to find high quality evidence, that says one way or the other whether or not something's proven effective or it isn't proven effective. And so that's what that theory-based rating means. The other thing that I would add is we recently, with support from the legislature last year, stood up an impact evaluation team in our unit that is intended to create new evidence for Minnesota-specific programs. So most of the research that we use in the inventory when we make that rating is based on evidence that exists from these national databases. And so we're relying on this robust research from outside of Minnesota. And through conversations with the legislature and our state agency partners, it was recognized that it would be important to evaluate using these high quality standards Minnesota-specific programs. And so the impact evaluation team is creating evidence where previously we've been kind of citing existing evidence. They're creating evidence so that in certain instances we'll be able to take one of those theory-based programs and, if it's appropriate, run an experiment to see whether or not it's effective or not so that we can give it a rating in a Minnesota-specific context.
Representative Harrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sir, do we get rid of any of these programs as a result of this initiative that we have?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not in a position to make that determination.
So MMB doesn't, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Representative Erickson.
So MMB doesn't make any recommendations as to, you know, as I'm looking at this chart for higher ed, makes no recommendation. Or the advisors to this initiative, this result, this evidence-based, about, you know, I serve on the audit commission, and we have some really good audits done, and you know sometimes we take a recommendation and you know change the program or even suggest eliminating it, but I don't see that occurring here. There's no recommendation, so. How do we know what direction to go?
Mr. Carter.
As lawmakers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, two things. One, I would say again that the theory-based determination is neutral. So it's not a negative rating. It means we just don't know enough information at this point to say whether or not a program is effective or not. The second thing about making recommendations, it's we're in a position to provide the information to decision makers, so to the legislature, to executive branch leaders, to the audit commission, for you all to make decisions. We feel like it's important that you have the best information available to make those decisions using high quality evidence. But it's up to you or executive branch leaders to make that decision.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for inviting them to be here. This is really good information for us to have. I'm wondering how you deal with sort of the conundrum of what and who gets studied and who doesn't. And I'm thinking specifically, you know, like the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We, for decades, knew anecdotally in our communities that was a problem, and it's only in like recent years where it's actually the data's actually starting to be tracked and collected. And so you wouldn't necessarily be able to say one way or another whether something was proven effective because you wouldn't have the data. So I'm just wondering how you sort of deal with that issue.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. At a high level, our work is guided by what the initial authorizing legislation provided the scope for. So we started with human services and criminal justice programs. Since then, we've expanded to look at other areas, and a lot of that work's been guided by our advisory committee, where they've made a recommendation specifically to look at education. That wasn't in the initial scope, but since then we looked at higher education and our currently looking at E-12 education. We also appreciate kind of input and feedback just from legislators, from executive branch leaders on kind of where our work goes. We want our work to be, one of our goals is that our work is used. And so if we're looking at an area that isn't being used, we should probably look at something else. And so we appreciate the input from you all as well.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think part of what I'm getting at is not necessarily what you would choose to study, but if sort of across the country an issue isn't given priority or doesn't have the funding to do the studies, then we're just not going to have the information. So you're not going to be able to point to whether it's proven effective. And then my other question for you is related to that. How do you assess or do you assess sort of differential outcomes for different populations? For example, you know, if we took a sample just of, you know, generic sample of Minnesotans, a program might not work for most folks within that sample, but maybe the program's super effective for folks from specific cultural communities or backgrounds. And I'm just wondering if you look at that when you're looking at the results.
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to the first question, there is, and we're aware of, inherent research bias that exists. The things that are interesting and have results tend to get published in papers. We just learned of recently there's a paper that publishes just null results, meaning things that don't show anything. And that's sort of a big deal to publish something that doesn't say anything while also saying something. So we're aware of that, and I think the impact evaluation team that I mentioned before is a great opportunity for us to kind of move those levers a little bit within Minnesota, where we're the ones deciding what are we studying, how are we studying, and who are we studying. To the question about differential outcomes, this is something that we're doing a deep dive on right now, again, because we understand that there has been research bias in the past, and so if we're relying on research that exists, we want to know who was studied, in what context, how was that program implemented, and so we're going back and looking through every study that we've used to make a rating, and are looking at who were the individuals studied by race, ethnic group, age, geography, and a few other components, so that we can at least, again, further inform the discussion. We might not be able to make a systematic determination about what do these conclusions mean and what are the outcomes for each of those individual populations, but we can provide links to the research and kind of say, in totality, here's who was studied when in these programs that we provided a rating for.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I'm the only one in the room that's actually served on the advisory council. And we've actually lost quite a few members. When I first started, we had Tara Mack. She's not here anymore. We had then-Senator Tony Laurie. He's not here anymore. Unfortunately, Diane Loeffler passed. So I'm wondering, have you replaced some of those legislators? Because it's really hard to get the message out if there's only me left on the advisory council. So our advisory committee. So that's my first question. And also I would just emphasize, too, the fact that you are looking at national data, not just specific to Minnesota, to try to put a better picture on. Is this best practices? You know, are these beneficial in other places as well? And I guess I didn't realize that 50% of the different programs that you've looked at already are really just theory-based, which I know Minnesota said it is innovative and we try new things, but I didn't realize we tried, like, it was that much. That's a lot of unproven programs that we're doing here in Minnesota. So that's a little concerning to me. But I think, you know, this has been a conversation that we've had since we first started the advisory committee, is that to try to get the connection to the data to the legislators has been a challenge. Whether it goes through a state agency that looks at it or the chairs of committees. So I actually applaud you, Chair, for presenting, because this is the first, I mean, I serve on seven committees, so this is the first time I've actually heard a presentation from Results First in any of the committees, and at least to know what it is, but much deeper than that, to actually find out what they have found out, because they've done quite a bit of analysis that's available for all of us to look at. So I applaud you for doing that. I would encourage you to do the same with other committees and other chairs, because this information has been out there for quite some time and we just haven't availed ourselves to dig in and read the reports. And again, I think I'm the only one left. I don't know how many legislators you even have left on your advisory committee, but maybe we need to fill it up again so you have more voices than just me.
Representative O'Neill, thank you for your work in this area. I didn't realize you were on this
from the beginning.
Committee. Very good. Yeah. Mr. Carter, any responses there? Yep.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are currently the only House member on our advisory committee. Mm-hmm. There are three members from the Senate that are still on our advisory committee, but we have four open slots for legislators that MNB leadership is reaching out to try to fill. But if any of you are interested by this presentation or you know colleagues who are, reach out to Representative O'Neill or myself, and we'd be glad to have a conversation about bringing you on board. You also mentioned citing national research, and that is a lot of where we go is research from other contexts outside of Minnesota. There is some Minnesota-specific work, but even though we are citing information from outside of Minnesota, and because we have that high standard of evidence, we feel like it's the best information available for decision makers. It's not perfect. The ideal world would be to have done an impact evaluation on every Minnesota-specific program, but that would be a lot of work and very costly, and so we're using the best information available with that high quality, high standard of evidence, and bringing it in a Minnesota context. And there is an opportunity, again, for those impact evaluations for us to study those programs in a Minnesota-specific context. Finally, I would welcome any recommendations for how we can better get the message out. The more advisory committee members would help, but we really do believe in our work and have seen how it's impacted legislative and administrative decision making. And so if any of you have recommendations for how we can use this information better, or we can do our work differently to help inform your process, please let us know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I know we've had that conversation since we first started. Was it 17 that we started, I think? So I know that we had recommended that you get a hold of the CAs that kind of control all the committees. And I know that you're not doing it in every single committee area, the research. You've been heavily in Health and Human Services and heavily in Public Safety, which is why I was so interested in that, and which is why former member who just passed, Diane Loeffler, was so interested. And she and I were faithful attenders, you know, and had many conversations. And she was sort of the expert in her area, and I got to speak about mine, so it was good. But, you know, I would recommend in the interim maybe to gather those CAs and make sure that they're aware of this data so that they can incorporate that in each of their budget presentations for agencies and looking at programming that way. I just want to get that on the public record. I've said that multiple times in the advisory committee, but I think that's a good place to start and make sure that the staff who organize the committees and schedule things are aware of that so that they can have, so the committee can have a comparison of here's the data, here's what's effective, here's still theory-based, because I know we do a lot of innovative things in Minnesota, but if we've done that innovative thing for 10 years and see no results, then maybe we need to look at something else. So I appreciate you doing that work. But that's what my recommendation would be since I've been on it since the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you. Good suggestions. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Carter, for presenting this. In my involvement with measurements and determination of effectiveness, it always boils down to what you're measuring. And, you know, as an example, if you have a program that you want to get people more employed, you can just count the number of people that don't have a job and then do have a job, or you can also then look at what kind of job did they get. And so what kind of process do you have? How do you screen the measurement process so that you know what you're measuring is actually what is the intent of the particular program?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. In the eight areas that we've looked at so far, we identified a handful of outcomes for each of those areas that we assessed for high quality evidence that existed for those programs. So, for example, again, tying back to adolescent alcohol use, the outcomes that we looked at in this area were underage alcohol use, illicit drug use, tobacco use, and substance misuse or harm. So those were the four kind of outcome areas that we looked at in the research to determine, does a program move the needle in one of those four areas? And then in each of the other subject areas that we looked at, there were different outcomes that we were looking for. So in some programs, there are obviously different outcomes than others. In child welfare, for example, there were out-of-home placement was one of the primary outcomes that we were looking at. So it varied as we went through those different areas.
Representative Peter.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So do you go back and listen to testimony and the intent of the bill authors and stuff when you'll determine what the outcome should be?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware that we've done that for each of these programs. I don't think we're in a position to kind of go back and look at each of these, the history of each of these 550 programs to that level of detail. But if there's a program that you're interested in or considering changing, we can kind of do that deep dive and assessment for you.
Representative.
Thank you. Just a final comment. The reason why I ask is because sometimes a bill or something, a program gets put in place, and people after the fact assume that the program was for a particular piece. And if your measurement for what the assumption is rather than what the intent was, you're measuring something wrong. And so it's important to know why the program was put in place and what was it intended for, because otherwise you're measuring something that may not be what was desired. So just a comment.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So in Health and Human Services Finance, Chair Liebling requires that if you're bringing a bill forward, you need to check the results first website. And so they've been to our committee, and authors try to do that to see if there's any research out there that relates to their bill. So I think it's a good practice to establish. But my question is, could we send, if we have areas where we want you to investigate research, national or state-based research, is there a list of priorities that your office could work to address, or how do you decide which things get evaluated, and could we submit a list if we have interest in one topic area?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we take what we call kind of one-off requests from legislators all the time. So far, it's been a reasonable amount of work, and so we haven't necessarily had to kind of do some massive prioritization, but it seemed to be successful so far. If it got to that point, I think we would probably tap the advisory committee to help us kind of do some of that prioritization.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carter, I'm looking at the levels of evidence, and the phrase effectiveness, research on effectiveness, is contained in all six. Granted that, I'm sure that the choice of using that word is based on the different programs in which you are evaluating, but being in the tax committee here, is part of that effectiveness the cost-benefit analysis, you know, how much a program costs per the perceived outcome? Is that measured as part of this?
Mr. Carter.
In general.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great question. In the eight areas that we've looked at so far, we've done some cost-benefit analysis for some of the programs. There isn't always enough data available for us to do those, but a small portion in each area has had a cost-benefit analysis done. The information we use, again, there is primarily from a national context. We plug Minnesota-specific data into a national model that the Pew Foundation provided to us. So, again, our hope is that the cost-benefit analysis provides some of that insight. It's, you know, probably not enough to make a fiscal note decision that we would rely on Department of Revenue for a revenue note for. But, again, it begins to get at a little bit of that return on investment concept.
Interesting. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, there is a rating entitled Culturally Informed. So programs sometimes are looked at for their cultural effectiveness. But Mr. Carter, my question is, what's the budget and how many staff are involved in this evidence-based program?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have the budget information with me right now, but I believe we're currently at about 15 staff in our division right now doing results-first work, performance management work and impact evaluation work are sort of our three main lines of projects that we're working on right now.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question. So do any of those 15 actually do the research, or is that then done through Pew, or, I mean, collected through Pew? Because I know they're involved in this as far as data collection. So do any staff do the actual research?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of those teams is composed primarily of PhD research scientists who are doing that impact evaluation work. They're designing experiments, kind of Minnesota-specific research, and plan to publish their findings. So they're kind of creating the evidence, whereas most of the individuals on the other team were working to kind of pull existing evidence that already exists.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are these PhDs perhaps funded through grants, through, you know, nonprofits or other organizations to do this research?
Mr. Carter.
Sounds like good, you know, thesis material.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the only funding component that I'm aware of was from last session to fund those impact evaluations, but I can get you the additional funding sources.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have another suggestion, and I did not come up with this in fairness. So this is actually great. So when we have our House research summaries prepared for us by nonpartisan research, if they would include what the rating is and a link and maybe some documentations from Results First, that would be really helpful, whether it be a fiscal analysis or the House research summary. I think that would be helpful. Again, that doesn't come from me. It's from our wonderful research staff here. That's his suggestion.
Another thing. So great suggestion, but let's see how that would work.
I think that would be a good combining of the efforts there.
Thank you. Mr. Carter, how is the work that you do there at Results First used in the budgeting process? So when Governor Walz presents a budget, what impact does your work have on that budget, and how is it used?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned with Representative Schultz, as legislators can approach our team and ask for a review of a certain proposal, the governor in his budget creation process has also asked our team to review certain proposals, and so we have done that and continue to do that as the budget's prepared.
Mr. Carter, when you look at some of these research items, and I could see some of these being pilot programs, potentially, you know, maybe a county trying one of these that, you know, we used to have a board, and I forget what the name of it was, but it dealt with innovations that cities and counties and local units or even nonprofits could come in and ask this board for kind of seed money to work on a pilot project. And, you know, you can see if it works or not. How could something like that work where there might be people that come forward to you? Because doing innovation in the public sector is very risky. And that's why in the public sector there tends to be not a lot of innovation, because if you fail, just the public and, you know, I mean, it just, there's too many downsides as you try to, you know, just, you can't really be very risky because you got public dollars and so forth. But potentially, if you had various little groups working on pilots that might show effectiveness, and how would that work into what you're doing, Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, I can think of two possible ways. The first is at the onset when either the legislature or an agency is deciding on what to fund, of looking at what programs exist that move the needle towards whatever the desired outcome is, either in a Minnesota-specific context or in a national context. The second is some of the work that our impact evaluation team is doing right now. They, again, as a part of last year's legislation, are working with some of the opioid money that was dedicated last year for grants across the state. And they've been a part of the process from the beginning to help design the grant programs in a way that can be evaluated. So rather than kind of joining the discussion after the fact just to look retroactively. They're a part of the discussion to set up those pilots so that they can be evaluated and results can be determined from that.
Very good. I'm going to make one kind of final comment, and I think Representative Carlson L. had a question, then we'll conclude. But, you know, we've talked a lot about outcomes. And, you know, I think if, you know, set up our committees, you know, we name them education finance instead of maybe it should be the high student achievement committee or health and human services finance should maybe be the healthier Minnesota committee or public safety should be the safer communities committee. I mean, we always focus kind of on the inputs rather than what we really want to do. And I think what you're doing is really looking at the outcome. So a city might look at how do we get to a certain safety rating so that the public, let's say on a 1 to 5 scale, the public, we want to get a 4 scale of people feeling safe in their community. And some respects, they'll look at the number of police officers, kind of the input, and think the more police officers going to do that, when in fact, it may not take more police officers. And if you focus more on the outcome, you say, how much will it cost to get to this outcome? And it may or may not be more personnel, or it might be just different ways of doing things. And so we tend to work on inputs versus outcomes, which I think would be better. Even in committees, we tend to think in terms of pupil units and whatever, rather than how do you get to a funding result of closing the achievement gap by 3% or whatever that might be. And so that's what's really encouraging about your work here, is that focus on efficiency and outcomes. And now it's how do we put a kind of a price tag on getting to these various outcomes? So thank you so much, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't asking to be recognized. Oh, the activity at this end of the table, I was signing committee reports from last
okay,
night.
Okay, very good.
And they'll probably be back for some more.
So, well, very good. Chair Davids.
I was paying attention.
Duly noted in the minutes. We'll get that in. So, Mr. Carter, thank you. So, and you might get more requests from other committees after your presentation, but I learned a lot. This is very, very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I'm looking forward to, as bills come forward, as long as you're in the legislature, that there will be a Marquardt amendment that requires that all new programs just are pilot projects. Then that way we can actually check to see if they work. And then if they do work, we can reinstate them. And if they don't work, they're gone.
We will see if we'll work on that, Representative. Maybe the Fabian Marquardt or Marquardt Fabian amendment. There you go. Mr. Carter, thank you so much. So the next one we're going to move to is looking at local units of government. And this is the a local performance board. I never get the full thing. That was started back in 2010 with kind of the premise that in 2021, we're going to spend about $3.9 billion on property tax aids and credits in that area. And so a lot of that's local government aid, county program aid, homestead credit, state refund, renters refund, all those type of things. And yet if I was to ask everyone around this table, could you really tell me in your local communities what type of results you're getting in the area of public safety, snow removal, you know, those type of things? Could you actually say, do you know what type? The only time you might know is if you get a call or a complaint or something. And so this program, the idea was to try to provide information and where cities and counties would look at and measure kind of what are citizens thinking about the services they're receiving with the tax dollars they're paying to local governments. And so with that, it's very nice to have our state auditor, Julie Blaha, here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And I'll let you take it away. Thank you for being here.
It's always glad to come here and talk about the great work at the Office of the State Auditor. And before I even begin, though, I wanted to comment on, Chair Marquardt, you'd mentioned a group in the last discussion. I think you were talking about the Board of Innovation and Cooperation, which was, at the time, administered out of our office. And I believe it sunsetted.
It did.
Yes. But what an opportunity, and I'd love to talk with you about that further.
Another day.
So Getting back to this, again, thank you so much for having us here. This is one of the key areas of the work we do at our office to oversee the over $40 billion we spend in local government. This is coming out of our Government Information Division, of which I've brought most of, are sitting here, and Christy up here too. And so this program is something I think that is one thing that's unique about it. It is one of the most customizable programs we have on evaluation and communication with our communities. It's one of the few programs that is very specific to the entity that is part of that and is determined by the entity themselves. It's kind of the essence of local control. That not only are they making decisions, but they're deciding, again, what do we need to track to make sure that those decisions are working. So specifically, the performance measurement program, it's a set of standards for counties and cities that will help Minnesotans determining the effectiveness, the efficacy of providing services and measuring residents' opinions. So not only measuring the specific program, but measuring opinion about that program and getting that information out to people. So to get more specific, we'll talk today about, again, kind of how this was developed. Then we'll talk about some trends that we're seeing in the program. And finally, feedback we're getting from people who have recently left the program that I think will help inform you on what you might want to do next. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our experts in our department. With us today is our Information Division Director, Kathy Doctor, and also our senior researcher, John Jernberg, is with us today to answer your questions. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this over then to Director Doctor.
Director Doctor, thank you for being here. Please state your name.
But I think out loud for once.
Sounds good. And just make sure you speak into it and good loud voice.
Chair Marquardt, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us this great opportunity to be here to talk about our program here. The Performance Measurement Program provides an opportunity for local governments to communicate with its citizens on how well it's providing its services. For reference, I'll refer to local governments under this program as cities and counties, as townships are not included in this program. The Performance Measurement Program also provides its citizens a chance to share their thoughts and opinions on local government services. This morning I will summarize the background of the Performance Measurement Program as well as the program requirements. John Jernberg, our lead financial analyst, will be discussing the numbers. I would also like to bring your attention to Christy John. Christy is also one of our analysts in our division, and she works directly with the local governments, answering questions and reviewing the information that's submitted to our office. To assist you today, we have prepared a handout. It should be in your packet. It looks like this, and I'll try to identify the pages that I will be talking about. Starting on page one of the handout, in 2010, the legislature created the Performance Measurement Program. Two Minnesota statutes make up the Performance Measurement Program. They are 6.90, titled Council on Local Results and Innovation, and 6.91, titled Local Performance Measurement and Reporting. Those statutes are included in your handout and are on pages 6 through 9. Starting with 6.90 on page 6, the Council on Local Results and Innovation was created. It was an 11-member team to develop a standard set of approximately 10 performance measures for cities and 10 performance measures for counties to aid residents, taxpayers, and state and local officials in determining the efficacy of counties and cities in providing services and measure residents' opinions of those services. In 2013, the Council developed additional and updated existing standards for the Performance Measurement Program, so it was more comprehensive and it would be more helpful to varying sizes of cities and counties. In your handout, you will see the standard measures charts for both cities and counties. Identified at the bottom is an asterisk identifying which were the newly or updated performance measurements. Besides setting the standards, the Council is to promote the Performance Measurement Program and act as a resource. The Council shall annually report to the committee with jurisdiction over taxes in the House of Representatives and Senate by February 1st each year on participation in and the results of the performance measurement program and any revisions to the standard. Also, the council is to meet a minimum of once per year. I will now briefly discuss the steps a city or county must follow to participate in the performance measurement program and how much money they can receive for participating in this program. This information is found in Minnesota Statute 6.91 on page 8 of your handout. First and most importantly, this is a voluntary program, not a required program, a voluntary program. Now, if a city or county chooses to participate in this program, they must formally decide by passing a resolution that they are going to participate in the program, that they have adopted and implemented at least 10 of the performance measures, they have a system to manage and evaluate the program, and they will continue to report the results to its citizens by the end of the year through publication, direct mailing, posting on the website, or through a public hearing. In order to assist local governments, we created a draft resolution for cities and counties, and this is on page 5 of your handout. After a city or county has adopted the performance measurement program, completed their surveys, and or gathered information, they have their results, then they must annually, by July 1st each year, submit the resolution and results to the Office of the State Auditor. We review the information for compliance with the program, and in the beginning of August, we provide the Department of Revenue with a list of those cities and counties that have met the program requirements and are eligible for the local program aid. Participating and eligible cities and counties receive 14 cents per capita with a max of 25,000. The law also allows an exemption from levy limits. However, levy limits have not been in effect for some time. The Department of Revenue releases the local program aid in December each year to the participating and eligible cities and counties. We also post the resolutions and results annually for each city and county on our website. Now I would like to introduce John Jernberg to discuss the numbers and the feedback we've received from local governments.
Mr. Jernberg, so is that correct? Mr. Jernberg?
Yes.
Very good. Correct. Please state your name and thank you.
Okay. Chair Marquardt and members of the committee, my name is John Jernberg. I work as a research analyst with the Government Information Division at the State Auditor's Office. We're asked to provide some history of this program, which Kathy kind of went over, and also kind of some trends that we're finding within the program in terms of participation and the amount of dollars that have been distributed through this program. The first trend is participation. Just in raw numbers, the number of cities and counties that participate in the program. And there's a table on page 1 of our handout that shows the participation by counties and cities since 2011, which was the first year of the program. 2011 was also the highest participation of cities and counties in the program, with a total of 151 cities and counties participating. Since that time, the numbers have generally trended downward, but have leveled off over the last 3 or 4 years. The lowest participation that we've had was in 2016, when a total of 46 cities and counties participated. And the most recent data from 2019 shows 57 cities and counties participating. There is a graph on the second page that shows this trend. The other thing we looked at was participation rates in terms of number of cities as a percentage of the total number of cities, and the same with counties. And overall, there's been a 31% participation rate among counties on average, and 5% among cities on average. The next thing we'll look at are total payments since the inception of the program. And that there's a table on the bottom of page 3 that show the actual dollar amounts. Just like the number of participating local governments was highest in 2011, the greatest amount paid out was also in 2011, where a total of $612,580 was distributed or reimbursed to cities and counties participating in the program. Since its inception, the program has paid out
We could add that up for you in a minute if you want.
Sure, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. I thought I had it written down, but I guess I did not.
That's fine.
So we've been, the amount paid out is generally based on the population of the entities that are participating, because it's a per capita based reimbursement, but also the number of participating entities. And the lowest amount paid out in a given year was $387,000, in total, $387,000, $866. And that amount has kind of gone down and gone up based on participation level. There's a graph on page 4 chart that kind of shows the trends in payouts by cities and counties. When we were asked to, kind of evaluate why has there been a decrease in the number of cities and counties participating in the program, we asked them what things stop you from or have made the program less desirable to participate in. And what we heard was that reimbursement was too low in comparison to the cost of implementing the program, a lack of staff to implement the program. Since there are no longer levy limits, that had been a big incentive early on in the program. Back in 2011, there were still levy limits going on, and so there was a big draw for that part of the program. When the levy limits were no longer in effect, that also made it less attractive for participants in the program. Others, the citizen response rate was so low on the surveys, and it was so low, and local governments did not have the staff to follow up on it. And also the response rate on surveys was so low that local governments felt that the responses were not representative for the community at large. And finally, that the program funding has not changed and is not keeping up with inflation. So those were the kind of the primary responses we received on why cities and counties were no longer participating that had been participating in the past. And that's kind of a wrap on the numbers on trends.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jernberg. Auditor Blaha.
Okay, we're trying to figure out this microphone situation here. I think in summary, what we're seeing is a program that I think has some great utility in getting communities talking about the facts about how things are working. And I think there's a great value in that and being very transparent about that. And I think the conversation is not only in sharing the results, but figuring out what measures are the measures that tell you what you need to know about your community. There's a great value in that process as well. I believe that though what we're seeing with the participation, and though it's leveled off, it's clear that the program could use some maintenance. We could tidy this up, and I think increase. There are ways to increase participation. Also, I think this may be a good time for us to reinstate the council. That has sunsetted as well. So that may be an opportunity. We would love to have this conversation ongoing in our office. And so we'd love to bring that back and have that conversation. Of course, if it's in statute, then that conversation, you get to decide who's in that conversation. And so we could certainly pull people together. But when it's come through statute, I think there's been a benefit in that lots of different people decide who gets to be part of that council. And I think there's a great benefit to that as well. So again, overall, a program that I think has great potential because of its local control aspects, its deeply customized apps and at opportunities. But I think it's a good time for you to be looking at it and seeing what kind of maintenance it needs to stay relevant. And so with that, we're available for any questions you may have.
So members, any questions? First of all, thank you to the Office of the State Auditor for implementing and working this project through and for the presentation today. And it's, you know, it's actually, you know, the council expired, what, January 1st of this year?
It did.
Without much fanfare, either which way. I don't think anyone recognized. And we weren't really utilizing or requiring reports and so forth, which really was our responsibility. And members, just like results first, and we did get a price tag. That's about $800,000 a year is what we have on that. And what were the payouts? Roughly $450,000 a year. So it's costing money to do this, but I would really strongly argue that the information we're getting, if we use it properly, would pay for itself many, many times over in efficiencies to our taxpayers. And just like right now, we're not using any of this information that the state auditor is getting. We're cities and counties are putting this information in. But one of the goals when this was set up is to be able to not compare cities and counties with one another, but to look at various ones. So you've got a city where the rating is very high, where people feel safe, and their per capita spending on law enforcement is, let's say, pretty efficient. I think we'd want to know what they're doing there and develop best practices, and then to be able to share that with other cities and counties around the state. I mean, you can imagine the potential in cost efficiencies and service delivery improvement that you could glean from this, and we haven't been doing that. But I do think this is an effort that we need to ramp up a little bit and change a little bit, maybe create some more incentives. Right now, the incentive is 14 cents per capita. And, you know, even with inflation, that might go to 16.8 cents per capita. It's no great shakes. And maybe that's, I actually had a bill last year that we heard in property tax committee, not in full taxes, where I upped the amount so that no matter kind of what size city you were, you would could at least get a half-time position, and the larger maybe a full-time position, just to work on this. Again, costs some money, but I think the return would pay for itself many times over in the long run. So I'm open to comments or questions, and Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what we're finding, though, when you go out and talk to county commissioners and city officials is their budgets are stretched. And whereas in the beginning you saw the numbers that there were 150 participating, and within 3 or 4 years it was a third of that. And one of the things that we have to glean from that is that they didn't feel the effectiveness to themselves.
Right.
And so when we put together a program in which we think, well, we can glean to help others, but having the communities pay for it itself, when they're struggling even to find money just for roads and bridges, it's difficult for them to justify that. So I think we have to understand if this is going to be something that's valuable, it has to be valuable statewide, and there has to be a little bit more reimbursement there, and I know you're working on that. So,
Representative Petersburg, you hit it right on the head there. And in fact, if we think this information is valuable and that we could glean some really good things, then we should, the state, I think, should pay for them to at least be able to do the program, so it's not an unfunded mandate that you're, even though it would be a voluntary program, but it knowing that the state could benefit a lot from this data, as could the citizens back home. Representative Carlson A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give a shout out to Westbrook for doing all this work for $99. I mean, come on. Yeah. There's way more than $100 worth of work in putting this together. And I think there's an argument to be made here that there just is a minimum standard, no matter how big the community is, in terms of the staff time to put this together. So I think, in addition, you know, if this is to continue, while, you know, the per capita piece, I think there may be some justification for that. There are other ways in which to get to that. I mean, perhaps it's just as simple as communities tracking their time and submitting a bill to get reimbursed for. That way it's at no cost to them. So I do agree with the chair that I think there's valuable information here, not only to the legislature, but to the citizens of those communities. I'm looking at the list of standards here. This is the kind of stuff that I want to know about. I want to know what the response time is for fire trucks and ambulances in my community. I want to know some of this crime data. I want to know some of the taxable property rates and so forth. I mean, this is all very digestible, I think, information that communities want to see, not for comparison purposes, but just in terms of quality of life. So, you know, there's a cost to doing business, and this isn't cutting it. So,
thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Representative Carlson, and a shout out to the town he mentioned for 99, yes. But, you know, I'm looking at the county's 27 measures. I also appreciate these measures, and I think we need to think outside of the box as to how could we get our, for example, counties. I don't think I'd have any cities participating, but counties to consider themselves doing this kind of analysis. I mean, it's a cost to them, but you know, I think of public safety, for example, in Mille Lacs County. I'd like to know the answers to all of these measures. And in Sherburne County, the public health social services are in all my counties. But, you know, I think we need to keep analyzing the benefit of this and the cost, and maybe promote it locally instead of a statewide program.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think everybody is making some really good points here. A lot of this information cities already provide internally when they're doing their measurements and setting their budgets, but a lot of these, looking at the 27 criteria, 10 of them are citizen ratings, so that would mean a survey, and surveys for cities are really can be expensive, but very, very, very useful, but most cities don't do one every year. Yeah. So wondering if we do retool the program, looking at it for a way that cities could participate, but maybe on an every 2 year basis, because citywide surveys, depending on how large your town is and how effective you want the survey to be, they can cost upwards of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. And if the return is capped at $25,000, what they get by the time you add in city time as well, staff time as well, you know, you're getting that, where's the incentive there too, so.
Very good. I'd like to get a hold of that legislator that set that amount at 14 cents per capita. I'd love to get a hold of that. You might be looking at him, actually. $99? Are you kidding me? Any further comments? Any closing comments? Anything you'd like to make? Auditor Blaha, and I just really appreciate you coming forward and also the work you've done on this program to keep it going and so forth. So,
thank you, Chairman Marquardt and representatives. I think you're hitting on a lot of the key things that we're hearing. I mean, the idea of the cost of it. It's one thing that this benefit this has beyond what people are already doing is that it pulls it all together, and it also makes sure it gets out to the public. And that time of picking your most important indicators for that year has another value. Now, I'm also talking about this as a teacher that used to do this very same thing. And that value is something I think a little unique. I think you're all right about the idea that the funding has to be looked at to make it attractive. And also, I think the value of that council, I think the idea of getting together to talk about how do we get this going forward. And we I think you brought this up as well. Our plan then is to offer the opportunity to come back each year. And next year, we'd like to come back, though, with results, a report that helps you encapsulate the results that we've seen and the trends that we see in those results so that you can help make other decisions. So that is something that we're definitely reviving as well, and I'm glad you made that. You pointed that out.
Thank you very much. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for delaying the meeting a minute or so. But, and you know, the auditor's office, I think, is working hard to kind of change the tone. I think that the previous auditor created a lot of distrust, and I appreciate what you folks are doing. When you take a look at the numbers of cities and counties and so forth and how the participation rate has declined, you know, if there is value in what you're doing, the way that you're presenting that to the counties, it does a tremendous amount into the cities. And I know Chair Marquardt, You believe, and I believe, that that Becker County and Kitson County and Rosa County, they actually do a pretty doggone good job of managing their resources and squeezing, you know, everything that they can out of a dollar. And I think that oversight and stuff like this is really good. But as legislators, members, we need to demand the same thing of state government and agencies. And if you go back up to the Iron Range or Becker County or Kitson County and you ask folks who needs more oversight, their cities and counties or the state agencies, I guarantee you what the answer is going to be. So we need to continue moving forward with more accountability and so forth from state government. Thank you.
Right. Representative Fabian, great points. And you know, the major thing of even those local guys, like, kind of gather information for their residents and that. What I don't want it to be, excuse me, is a state government, you know, okay, you're only here, so now you've got to, you know, that's the last thing we really want, but just the accountability. But point very well taken. Thank you. Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Representative Fabian. To kind of speak to that, I'd love to say my incredible great leadership is changing everything. But let's be really clear. Whenever we talk about sometimes the drama that sometimes we have between us, rarely is in our staff and our offices. You know, when you talk about you talk to local government officials and they talk about our office, everyone loves the people who work in my office. It's my first year in, they still like me, but it's still the idea that I think the biggest reason that we had a drop was less about kind of the external political forces, but more the change in the levy requirement. That's where we saw the drop when that was no longer something that people really saw as a benefit on that. But I think it does, I think your point though really speaks to the great importance of a staff that remains incredibly, not just nonpartisan, but absolutely nonpolitical and stays focused and maintains relationships despite what sometimes the adventures we have on the political side are.
Auditor Blaha, Ms. Doctor, and Mr. Jernberg, thank you so much for your presentation. And members, have a great weekend. Remember, nothing next Wednesday. My next Tuesday, we are having a tax expenditure report. And then I'm going to let everyone off on Wednesday. So, members, we're adjourned. Have a great weekend.